Well, last night on Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett, we talked about tonight, and we said it was going to be a big show, and it is. It's going to deal primarily on the subject of oil, but we won't get there yet. By the way, if you have Streamlink, go back and catch last night's show with Brian Toohey. He's the skeptical sports fan, otherwise known by ESPN sports commentator as the sports conspiracy theorist. And he maintains that there is a trail of deception in professional sports that can be easily deciphered once you know that the fix is in. And that was the name of his book, and that is the that's the core of his argument, that the fix is in professional sports, both at the corporate level, at the broadcasting level, at the political level, through both refereeing and through the mafia, just even through the way in which sports itself is rigged, that you cannot trust the outcomes of most of these leagues. Now, he said individual games, you know, he's not here to say that every game is fixed, but storylines are fixed. You know, there's a reason why these series are drawn out to 6 and 7 games. Is that it literally accounts, each game accounts for millions of dollars per game. When you factor in both the gate and the advertising, it's in everybody's best interests. Every player is paid more in a 7-game series. And so he's just saying, just look at the statistics. For that matter, look at the number of, and I thought this was a very compelling argument, the number of Southern expansion cities in the NHL who then find themselves immediately competing for a Stanley Cup. It defies the odds, but it fits perfectly with the NHL's plans of bringing in more TV viewers, getting bigger TV money where possible, and then also, of course, getting more people to come and see hockey, this exciting new sport in town in these southern cities. Nothing gets people in like a team that's competing for the Stanley Cup, and lo and behold, oh, look, we got a new team. Oh, they're in the Stanley Cup. How about that? So just take a look at that. The fix is in. You might take a look at the book, but also now take, you know, keep that in mind when you're watching SportsCenter tonight. Hard to get away from that once that gets in your head a little bit, but worth going back and catching if you got Streamlink. If not, join Streamlink and find out more at coasttocoastam.com, where there are also details about our first guest, Catherine Ramsland, credited with writing more books than Moses, and in fact, as a professor and an author, she has a unique eye on the mind of the serial killer. So we've asked her to take a look at Joren van der Sloot, the Dutchman who was living in Aruba, who has confessed twice to the death of Natalie Holloway, who said that he was, for a price, going to tell the Holloway family finally what happened to her and where her body went last time he saw it, and then escaped with the money that they had given him for this information in a botched FBI sting, and went to South America and, according to published reports, killed another woman that he admitted to in very much the same way as one of his descriptions of Natalie Holloway. So the question is it true Bo Deedle said on CBS earlier last week? He said, "I've met this guy. He's a homicidal maniac. I looked him in his eyes. We should be checking Interpol, and the FBI should be checking where he's gone all over this world. You've got a serial killer here." There's one person whose opinion I trust more than any others to answer that, and we'll talk to her coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Catherine Ramsland, I can't even begin to guess what your latest book is about. She's probably written 3 since we last spoke.
Well, the latest one is called Inside the Minds of Sexual Predators.
How about that?
It's perfect.
You are the person, you are the go-to gal for a subject like this. And And also, I should say, too, that coming up next hour, we'll talk about the oil in the Gulf. One guest says we've got plenty of oil. The other says our oil supply is dwindling. And we'll get to both of those opinions as it pertains to the Gulf and exactly what's happening with that pipeline coming up on Coast to Coast. So with this book in mind, had you already been writing about Joran van der Sloot when he ended up back in the news?
No, I hadn't used his case because all we have for him right now is allegedly. Got to keep that in mind.
Yeah, well, we do and we don't we? I mean,
confession does not mean no, because he can recant. They have to get evidence to support that confession. If he recants, as this is not the first time he's confessed and recanted,
right?
So you have to get more support. You need really good evidence.
Okay, well, let's talk about that then, because Joran van der Sloot, what profile, if we just had to pull back a little bit and say, based on what you know, based on what we can read about a guy who police say had the date rape drug with him in Aruba, that he says she, Natalie Holloway, died in his hands, in one of his versions, mm-hmm. died in his hands, and he was like, I didn't kill her. I didn't have anything to do with that. I goes, he did hide the body, he said, you know, so I hired a guy to get rid of the body, but he said she just up and died. And then in another confession, she made him angry, and so he pushed her, and her head hit a rock. And in hitting a rock, that's when she died, and then he panicked, and then he got rid of the body. But pushing her and having hit her head is also the same story he told about the woman, Stephanie Flores Ramirez, in the hotel room in Peru. He pushed her, and she hit her head, mm-hmm. and then he finished her off. So what can you tell from those two stories about Joran van der Sloot as he describes himself,
he reminds me of the Joker, the Heath Ledger's Joker on Batman, who told one story after another about how he got, you know, the problems on his face.
Right, right.
Fluidly, easily, pathologically, lie for effect. I mean, he was constantly checking out people who's a predator. So that's what I think. This guy is deceptive, manipulative. He's always looking for effect. He's always looking for his own advantage. He's remorseless. The chances are good. I mean, he hasn't been diagnosed. I don't want to do that
right.
from the armchair. But, you know, he definitely has what you would think would be a psychopath, or certainly a narcissistic personality disorder at the very least. But the psychopath is a manipulative, deceptive, remorseless person who looks to his own advantage or her own advantage at all times, and will play people constantly just for fun.
So how does that work? Narcissistic personality is a case of somebody who does what that leads up to a psychopathic personality. What are the degrees between the two?
Well, we don't really look at it as the degrees. It's two different and distinct but overlapping personality disorders.
Okay.
Whereas with narcissistic personality, you're very much enclosed within your own self-concerns and very self-indulgent, but you still have room for remorse and for, you know, being engaged with people in a way. The psychopath is a much more cold-blooded type of person.
So they overlap in the sense that he sounds at least like a narcissist.
Yes.
But it may be worse than just narcissism, and that he really is in the psychopathic sphere. Right.
We're definitely looking at a guy who doesn't mind swindling his friends to get what he needs, you know, lying easily. He knows he's being watched, and yet he doesn't mind cheating people, you know, picking up girlfriends. Killing a girl, I guess he had espresso in the room while he considered what he was going to do, as if there wasn't a dead body lying right there. I mean, that was part of what he had said in his confession. So very, very cold. And if she had by accident fallen or something, you know, why didn't you tell someone? Why did he just leave?
Right, right.
You know?
The case of Natalie Holloway, to go back to the young girl, high school senior, the story is, it was, I believe it's been confirmed, is that when the Holloway family flew to Aruba, when they heard that Natalie had not gotten on the plane, they immediately flew to Aruba to assist in the search of their daughter. The police said, oh, she's going to turn up. She's off doing drugs with some guy. We've seen it a million times. Mm-hmm. They showed no particular concern. They did not send out anybody. And so the family took it upon themselves to investigate. They, you know, they started saying, okay, they tracked it down. They said, who was she last seen with? And they said, oh, it's this kid, Yoren. And so they went to where he was, mm-hmm. and they asked people that knew him. And the first thing the family said they were told is, oh, yeah, Yoren does that a lot. He's always looking for young girls. He's always looking to take advantage of girls. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, that's so interesting, because that seems like that would fit the profile right away of a predator. If other people right away are picking up that you're always on the prowl, at least in some low-level form, you're a predator. Would you not agree?
Absolutely. And there is some evidence that he was skulking around trying to find girls he could sell into prostitution and things like that. So, yeah, he's definitely a predator. But can we take the step to serial killer? Not yet. It's, at this point, it's all alleged.
Sure. Would you be interested in doing, knowing what you know, would you, Catherine Ramsland, say there would be a profit in going and tracking all of the different ports of call that Yoren Vandersloot has been in over the years to look to see whether there's another case that fits this profile in other cities around the world?
Yeah, I mean, from what we see of him, it's unlikely that he's done this 5 years apart without any other kind of activity in between. But the only problem with that is the level of investigative skill and record keeping you're going to find in these other countries might not be to the level you would hope for. So just because you go do that doesn't mean you're going to find cases. But I still think it's certainly worth doing, because I don't believe that with the attitude he has and his MO and his sort of offhanded feeling that he's untouchable, that he's only done this twice in 5 years. I don't think so.
Yeah, we heard that in the eyes of the Aruban police, the fact that he was the last one to be seen with Natalie Holloway, the fact that he had this sort of shaky story about having dropped her off at the hotel when there's no evidence that he had dropped her off at the hotel. Mm-hmm. Some of the early reports that had come from other people that had seen him taking her away to a beach, the Aruban police said, not enough evidence for us to arrest. We got to let him go. And then even after one of his first confessions, they said, oh, that's not enough evidence. We can't do anything with that. And then even after this case in Peru, the Aruban police said that they couldn't believe that the Peruvian police were going after this guy because it's such a flimsy case for the body that was in his hotel room. And so it makes me think, why some of what Yoren Vandersloot would be counting on was a weak police department, or at least a reluctant police department, whether that would be because of his father's connections or just because of his personality. What does that remind you of? And the other serial killers or other predators that you've examined over the years, are there other cases of people who have come to depend on sloppy police work and have been able to manipulate that to their advantage?
Well, yeah, I mean, we have a few. Ted Bundy was one who believed he was certainly more clever than the police. And, you know, he did get away with quite a few by moving from one state to another as soon as there was a lot of flack about missing girls or, you know, dead bodies. He then moved to another jurisdiction. And essentially, he got caught, you know, with a traffic violation, not
right.
with a murder. So, you know, there's somebody clearly who just thought he was better than the police. But we also had one who went from country to country. We've had a few who've gone from country to country expecting that the jurisdictions are not going to get their act together to make comparisons. And, you know, they were wrong about that. But what about the ones we haven't caught, you know, who weren't wrong? who actually have taken advantage of the fact that different countries have different standards and different record-keeping procedures, and some don't even do any kind of profiling or database analysis. So if you have countries like that, that would attract,
right,
serial killers, because they know it's so much easier to get away with something in those countries.
I was kind of reminded of Son of Sam a little bit, in that the police were reluctant to even look at it as that there was a connection between these murders, which only allowed that to continue on for a longer period of time. I know that may sound like a tenuous connection, but anytime the police soft sell something, I think sometimes it seems like it opens up the door for somebody who's willing to exploit that weakness.
Well, you get that in a lot of serial murder cases, in part because they don't want to unnecessarily frighten the community. And, it's politically incorrect, for example, to say that a city like New York is not safe.
So right.
There are all kinds of pressures on investigators, but they also don't want to panic people. They don't want people out there investigating on their own and trying to solve it. They don't want serial killer groupies running up there. There really are a lot of considerations for investigators in terms of why they might downplay it in the media, which doesn't mean they're downplaying it themselves.
The new book is about sexual predators.
Yes.
How often does somebody start as a sexual predator and end up a serial killer?
Well, it really depends on their degree of anger and the degree of, the kinds of, perhaps, kinds of pornography they look at, or what they need to satisfy them. If a rape isn't enough and they need violence, the chances are they will probably eventually turn to killing in order to satisfy that drive.
Assuming for the moment that Joran van der Sloot is has both of those cases where, as he's described them to police, that he got angry with Natalie Holloway, he got angry with Stephanie Flores Ramirez, that with that flash anger led to two girls' deaths, based at least on his testimony, whether we choose in the end to believe it or not. What does that tell you about him, that flash anger?
That he's impulsive. He feels immune to what he feels entitled to do whatever he wants to do, and probably has very little control when that anger begins. It's not I wouldn't call it snapping. I don't think there's any such thing, but he has already learned that nobody's going to stop him. And I think for some people, growing up in a privileged environment as he did, makes them feel as if they're untouchable and that they're better than everybody else. Not everybody, of course, but there are certain personalities that do feel that way. And so I think, the anger thing is part of his entitlement. I didn't get what I wanted. But I also think the fact that there were maps in the room that indicated he might have been considering putting the body in water. Well, did he bring those in before they were even in the room together? That would make me think that maybe he planned the murder, and this had nothing to do with a flash of anger and an accident.
Do you accept the connection that many people do, that there is a correlation between the treatment of animals, first originally dead and then live animals, and the future treatment of human beings in the case of serial killers? That frequently you can see the indicator is like animal abuse and torture and death?
I only accept that, there's this thing called the McDonald triad with the bedwetting, fire setting, and animal abuse, and that has actually been pretty much debunked, even though it keeps showing up in the literature. But torturing animals, yes, because they will start with something they can manage, that is something they know they can handle, and they have no sense of the feelings of the creature they're torturing. So yeah, there is definitely a correlation,
but not the bedwetting, fire starting thing.
No.
but at least the correlation between the animals. Then I want you to ponder something here for a second. Is there a similar correlation between sexual predators and something that they do at an earlier age, perhaps even an adolescent age, that is an indicator of them becoming sexual predators later on, or it's common amongst sexual predators that they practice one type of behavior. And I want to ask you about that. And then I have a vampire question for you. Are you good with a vampire question?
Sure. Okay.
I know it's sort of a sideline. Dr. Catherine Ramsland, always fun. Thank you so much. We're talking about Joran van der Sloot. And then I got a question in the twilight of the day that I'll be asking Dr. Catherine Ramsland too. We'll give you the phone number so you can join the conversation. And we go oil after the top of the hour. We need you on Coast to Coast. So we're just opening the door a little bit for you and Catherine Ramsland here in the next half hour. And then we'll get to Jim Bell in the next hour. Jim Bell is somebody who's been investigating oil and our relationship to energy on this planet for a long time. His new book is Creating a Sustainable Economy and Future on Our Planet. And he believes, as he describes it, that like any well-designed spaceship, our planet has a life support system, which is solar powered, and a solar powered recycling system, which we aren't taking seriously enough. He says that we have a limited amount, a finite amount of oil on this planet, and we run the risk of running this ship into the ground, if you will, if we don't see that. Then coming up the hour after him, a man who spent some time on the north slopes of Alaska to say that we got plenty of oil and peak oil is a myth. And then they'll both take your calls in the fourth hour on Coast to Coast. Also, a couple of very interesting experiences that that our third hour guest, Lindsay Williams, has had, which should make us all suspicious a little bit about what's going on in the Gulf. That's all I'll tell you for now. But Catherine Ramsland's got more to say about Joran van der Sloot as a forensic criminologist, as an author, as a professor. I asked her a question about her most recent book, a book about serial sexual predators, and we'll see what she says about that, plus a little bit about vampires and werewolves next. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. All right, so Catherine Ramsland on Coast to Coast AM, looking at your Wikipedia entry, it says that you have 37 books, but I have a feeling that's not accurate. Is it?
Do you have more than? I just turned in number 38, but it's not published yet.
That's what I thought. we'll get a couple of questions about Joran van der Sloot coming up in just a second. But while I've got you here, about the sexual predators in general, is there an indicator, a behavior that happens around adolescence or even before that's common to sexual predators that could make either parents look at, for more help, or would help investigators pinpoint when it all started?
Well, unfortunately, it's mostly secretive. It's excessive fantasizing, staying alone a lot, and thinking about sexual imagery, especially relating it to items like fetishes. So what happens is what's called orgasmic conditioning toward something, and sometimes it's about violence or sometimes it's about rape, something like that. But it's unfortunately difficult to pinpoint because it is a secret behavior.
So later on, you could find out what it was that they were fetishizing and fantasizing about, but there isn't anything that it's not like it's common for kids at 13 or 14 to get thrown out of dances or to inappropriately touch girls while they're, in class or anything like that.
They might do some experimenting. They might be caught like stalking or something that will indicate that they're willing to cross the line to do something inappropriate. So there might be that, but I can't tell you there's a given behavior that we see in every case or even in most cases because they're so individualized.
One of the reasons I asked was just looking at, again, more specifically in the case of Joran van der Sloot, his father was in a position of power. Mm-hmm. He seemed to know how to game the system. He was considered a darling in, his parents' estimation. He was a tall, good-looking kid who already knew how to work the floors of these discos that saw a lot of American girls coming in, you know, just for a weekend or for a week, and, right. and kind of seemed to knew how to separate out the vulnerable from the flock.
It's really about the individual person's perception of what he's seeing. I mean, you could certainly have that same scenario with a more responsible young man who develops good character and makes the right choices. It really has a lot to do with the person and what he feels entitled to, and whether or not he's getting what he feels entitled to, so that he's developing a sense of anger or a need to control or a need to denigrate women in some way. So it really it's very specific to that person's situation and what they think they can get away with. Clearly, this is a guy who lies easily, so I'm guessing he's lied a lot through his life easily.
Right.
Because he reaches for lies before he does anything else. And he even called himself a snake on his Facebook page.
Right.
And talked about, you know, how easy it is for him to lie. So I would guess that was behavior that started very young. And that would be a behavior of concern. Lies, manipulation, blaming others, not taking responsibility. I mean, we can actually see some of these patterns at as early as the age of 4 or 5. And if they're persistent and the child seems not to be able to learn, that is going to be a matter of concern. I think that's something parents need to look at.
And I could see where if your kid's good looking always has a good story, that there'll be people mm-hmm. might be more inclined to believe him, and the pattern
definitely.
Gets set.
And yeah, disempowers them even more.
And that idea that he contacted the Holloway family after 5 years had passed to say, for money, I will tell you what happened with Natalie, and I will tell you where that last time I saw the body, how I killed Natalie, mm-hmm. or how she died, I think maybe the very specific language, and where the body was last seen.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll do that for money. Contacting the mother of the victim like that, it seems beyond narcissistic and well into
the... Cruel. Yeah.
Very cruel. Into the
but
area
it's also,
of...
It is narcissistic in that it's all about, I want what I want for me, and I don't really care who gets hurt by it.
How this affects you. I'll save my vampire question for a second. Tom is east of the Rockies in Knoxville on Coast to Coast for Catherine Ramsland. Tom?
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Thank you for taking my call. Now, I think Bjorn's clearly a sociopath. And I've heard that he's offering to go back to Aruba to answer questions about Ms. Holloway.
Only to the Aruban police. Right.
Right. Okay. And I don't think Peru's ever going to let go of him. But do you think that he believes he can still connive or manipulate his way out of this? And do you think he still believes that do you think he believes it's over? Or do you think he still thinks, hey, he could get out of this?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question.
Like Ted Bundy, who really believed all the way up to his execution day he was going to get out of it somehow.
Right.
I think he thinks he's going to get out of it. But, you know, they can be very careful about the controls. They can actually get what they want without really giving him what he wants if they're careful about it. But, yeah, I do think he's gamed the system for so long. But I would still be careful to say he's definitely a sociopath or a psychopath, because that really actually requires a diagnostic, assessment. It's so easy for people to just sling that word around all over the place, but I think we have to be careful about that. Still, we do know he is successful at fooling people, deceiving people, swindling friends. I'm certain he thinks he's going to get what he wants.
Ray is somewhere in Illinois on a wild card line for Catherine Ramsland. Ray?
Yes, I got two questions, Ian. One first question is, if a person exhibits questionable or extremely violent behavior at some time, should that be an immediate sign to disassociate, or are there other signs? And my other question has to do with prescription medicines and the food chain. Now we got petrochemicals. We've got chemtrails every day at high and low levels, and I'm wondering what effect that will have on the population. And we have an aging population with Alzheimer's now, and I'm wondering what we could possibly expect in 10 or 20 years from now. And
okay, let's get those. You got two good questions there about the petrochemicals. Any Any idea on that effect? That do we see any reason to believe that somehow the population has been affected more by chemicals in our systems?
You asking that to me in terms of psychology?
Yeah, in terms of maybe even trending within, are we more violent now than we've ever been? Or if we see that there's been some sort of biochemical change in us over the last, say, generation?
No, there's no evidence for that.
We have
a lot of violence in our history.
Right. Well, then that is a question I actually had occurred to me earlier too, and I kind of wrote it down. Is what? Are we more violent now? Are we less violent now?
Here's what we are. We are more impulsive, with less ability to focus, and so because we have more of an ADD mentality, where we don't have much patience for things, that actually is a precursor to people who may become violent. And we do see different structures in the brain, especially in the frontal lobe where decision-making takes place. We do see problems with that. And so if we are doing things to change the brain, such as we have been doing with you know, the way we do videos and television now, where everything's very flashy and quick hit, and we're losing our ability to focus, yes, impulsivity means we're also losing our sense of control over our behavior and the kinds of things we need to do to consider important and complex decisions.
All right, that brings me back to the question I was going to ask you about vampires. Knowing that you've also studied that as well as some more sort of mainstream forensic psychology when it comes to crimes, when this country tends to cycle into a greater interest in vampires, and I think vampires have sort of come and gone over the years in terms mm-hmm. of their dominant popularity, what does it tell you about us that vampires and all things vampire in the media is again? What does that tell you about us? What are we going through that we seek release in vampire stories?
Well, the unusual thing that I've seen as I've watched this pattern is that it tends to really rise in popularity at the end of a significant time period, like the end of a decade. And then in the 90s, it was the end of the 90s, the end of the century, the end of the millennium. We had a huge surge of interest in vampires then. But we had it in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and now again, 2010, here it comes. I think it has something to do with pushing away the sense of closure that the end of a time period tends to, you know, subconsciously to do to us. The vampire is a creature of darkness that defies death, that is empowered, that is charismatic and sexy and has all kinds of energy. And so I think that it's, in a way, it's a collective burst of life, even though the vampire is the undead. It's still a collective burst of defiance against closure, this closing down of a decade or a century.
How about the shift? Is there a difference significantly between when we are as a population group interested in vampires and when we become interested in werewolves? Is werewolves a separate indicator?
It's, werewolves have not had the same kind of resurgence, although zombies for some reason have had that. Werewolves have not. And although we are seeing a lot of vampire stories that use werewolves because they run out of material so werewolves always somehow come into it, they haven't enjoyed the kind of recurring and intense popularity that vampires have.
I thought it was interesting when the screenwriter for the original Wolfman, for the Universal Pictures Wolfman, mm-hmm. died for the first time ever. I learned, I'm sure you already knew about it, that it was an extended metaphor for being the Wolfman story was essentially his own story of being a Jew in Nazi mm-hmm. Germany,
yeah.
and of what it felt like to be hunted for something that you had no control over,
mm-hmm.
and that you would suddenly become, you know, if you pardon the pun, the bane of everybody's existence. And it was so he felt when he was a teenager and then later immigrated to England and to the U.S. I think that's an interesting thought, that whether werewolfism and the werewolf stories reflect that we feel we've become victims of something and we're being hunted.
Well, that's certainly the way it was done in the 40s and 50s was that the werewolf really was a victim. And I think the new werewolf is that it isn't as much a victim of it. It actually uses, like, I think Werewolf in London was one of the first movies to actually kind of come to terms with it and use it more than the Wolfman pictures from the 50s. So it was less of a victim, but still, you know, it is. It's a curse. It's not something you necessarily want, but we certainly have werewolf stories out there that are equal to the vampire stories and in the feeling of, you know, this is powerful for me and I'm going to use it.
Well, I felt like a victim of a crummy ending on American Werewolf in London. I love that movie, but it's got the crummiest ending. It was like, oh, all that for this?
Well, I thought the same way the remake of The Wolfman was like, are you kidding?
I didn't even see it. The Benicio del Toro version. I'm kind of. It's going to be on cable coming up. I'm looking forward to catching it. Chris is in Newport, Rhode Island on a wild card line for Catherine Ramslin on Coast to Coast, and we'll switch to oil coming up. Hey, Chris.
Oh, hi, Ian. How are you?
Good. You're talking with Catherine. Go ahead.
All right. Yeah, I just wanted to get your take on this quote that I heard from Arianna Huffington this morning on her broadcast. And it says, civilizations die from suicide, not murder.
That's an interesting
thought. It really struck me, and I just...
Catherine, where are you with that?
I just watched Michael Moore's Capitalism and Love Story. That was exactly the theme of that. And I found it kind of compelling that we cannibalize ourselves by stripping ourselves of our resources to engage, you know, empower the rich and make them richer and richer, and we just don't do anything about that. We allow them to keep taking and taking, and pretty soon civilizations of that nature die because they rely on a predatory approach to life, and pretty soon the predator has to turn on itself because there's nothing else left. So I have to say, I think there's something to that.
Sounds a little bit more like the Frankenstein story.
Yeah, well, you know what happened to him.
we create a monster that eventually has to come for us.
Yeah,
that we disown, but it doesn't. It takes ownership of us, even if we don't take ownership of it.
Exactly.
Sue, west of the Rockies in Hawaii, for Catherine Ramsland on Coast to Coast. Sue. Question. Yeah.
Thanks for taking my question. A fascinating topic again. I want to ask a bit about anger. I've seen through at age 68, first of all, an acceptance of anger as being uncontrollable. And then it seemed to me in the 70s and 80s, we began to understand that anger really can be controlled. And anger management here in some years has had some success. And now it seems to me we're going back to this idea that, well, people who are angry really can't control their anger. And I think that's a sham. And
I think that's an interesting point. I think that's right.
I think it's too generic. I think that anger in general is one thing, but people with a mental illness to go along with it, who have really explosive anger, that's something else. And so that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about anger in the normal population.
Right. No, I think Sue's point is, I see that reflected in, this is my voice. You can't take my voice from me.
Right.
I'm angry.
Entitlement.
And I am entitled to be angry.
Right.
Even if it adversely affects everybody around me, that's my voice. You cannot silence me. Well, I wish we could have gotten everybody on, but I know that means that someday you'll come back, right?
Okay.
And thank you so much for squeezing us into a busy schedule and for shedding some light on the whole Joran van der Sloot thing. Catherine Ramsland.
Always fun being with you.
Good. Thank you. God bless you. Have a great week.
Right.
And coming up next, we'll get into the oil discussion. We'll start with Jim Bell, who may be familiar to some older listeners. Jim Bell on Coast to Coast, who says that we are using up these precious resources, and we better get a handle on this before we have nothing left. And then we'll get to an author who says exactly the opposite. We got so much oil, we don't know what to do with. That's not our problem. He'll explain what our problem is coming up in the next 2 hours on Coast to Coast.